Mike McPherson. I'm from the University of Virginia, also on the program committee for this year's conference. I want to say thank you for being here. We've got a great registration this year. I think this is going to be a great session, too. I want to remind you of a couple of things. Please, please take a minute, and that's all it'll take at the end, to evaluate the session. You can do it on the iPad app or the smartphone app or on the website, and we really actually use those evaluations when we're looking at proposals. We look at presenters' past history and take that into account, so very valuable stuff. Also, I want to remind you that this is a part of the online program, and so when you ask questions, please come to the microphone, speak loudly and clearly, identify yourself before you ask your questions, and we will, if there are any questions from the remote audience, we'll split questions between the House and the remote audience. So, welcome to everybody out there in remote audience land as well. Our speaker today is Anoop Gupta. He's distinguished, I'm having a hard time with my tongue this afternoon, I'm so sorry. He's a distinguished scientist at Microsoft Research. He focuses on collaboration, communications, and natural interfaces. Before he joined Microsoft, he was a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at Stanford. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say, so I'm going to shut up and give him the microphone. Anoop?
Thank you, Michael. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome, and thank you for coming to the session, and thanks to the virtual audience that we have today, too. I wanted to start this session with a question. In fact, I'm just trying to see if we can make this work. And to check, you know, how many people have kids in high school or college? Because, you know, so just raise your hand if you have kids in high school and college. I guess some, but not that many, because it starts hitting you, you know, what's happening in this industry quite a lot. We have three kids, a boy, a girl, and a boy. Two of them are in college right now. One is a senior and the other a freshman, and we have a 10th grader. So certainly, if we all rush up and make this revolution happen, for the third one, I was thinking, you know, maybe we can get by cheap, because the first two are costing, you know, over $50,000 a year that we need to deal with. So jokes aside, you know, there is some very exciting stuff that is happening in the higher education space, and I want to cover three things. One is I'll start with some challenges and opportunities that I see. I've personally been involved in this space a lot of my time, often not as the main thing, but even as you know, Stanford has been one of the early pioneers where they have been broadcasting their courses, having the local and actually remote community. So it's pretty closely involved there, and looking also within the company now, a lot of things that are happening. And then we'll go to some of the transformations. So in many ways, I think what we are having today is a perfect storm. And I don't look at it as perfect storm in the negative way where, you know, ships are sort of going down and everything is sinking, but that many distinct factors and economic and technological forces are coming together to drive some big changes, okay? And there are many of them, and I want to first just start with, you know, what are some of these forces? The first is simply to do with, you know, ubiquitous, affordable devices and connectivity. The prices of devices, you know, if you're buying a tablet, a laptop, it's pretty easy to get something for $300, $400, okay, a pretty solid device. If you are looking at on the lower end and what's happening in China, Taiwan, and, you know, you can start getting devices for $150. So it's suddenly becoming, you know, pretty affordable in terms of what we can do. This is both across, you know, tablets, laptops, phones, and what we're seeing, and things are getting just cheaper, and the technological curve will drive this further down. The connectivity is certainly increasing a lot, and, you know, this is a slide from Mary Meeker and Kleiner Perkins, where 2.4 billion people are now using the internet. this has just dramatically changed, and this is still growing, you know, 8%. To think of 1/3 of the world is connected is just absolutely amazing. And on the devices, actually, I wanted to make one meta point before we go on. People have focused on touch, okay, and touch has been fantastic, multi-touch in terms of driving the accessibility. I'm a big believer and a champion for the stylus, okay, that beyond touch, we also, when we think about devices for students, we've got to think about the pen and the cost of adding a true digital pen, not a thick finger or something like that. Most of us stopped finger painting, you know, at the age of 2 or 3, and we still continue to say, you know, you've got to do everything with just the finger. I think if we look at some of the examples of how we annotate, how we take notes, how do we do science, when we go and look for devices, we've got to be asking for more. Okay, I'm just a firm believer in that, and certainly, you know, from a Microsoft perspective, we made that an important emphasis, whether you look at Surface or you look at devices from Lenovo and HP or many of the others, that's them. So let's go to the second one in terms of, you know, in the storm, things that are coming together. We're certainly dealing with digital natives. So all of the YouTubes and videos and things like that, you know, learning from that is just standard. You know, as you think about the phones, you know, these kids did not have not known another future. And the problem right now is, used to be that in the school you had the most advanced environments. Today, when they come into the classroom, many of the kids, you know, they are going into a world where they say it's a pretty strange world in terms of, you know, what I'm trying to do. The third factor that makes it important in terms of the transformation that's taking place is, you know, Thomas Friedman's thing about a flattening world. When, you know, many times the question is raised in this country where people might say, hey, a high school education used to suffice and I could get a great living and a middle class living out of that, and why isn't it so? It isn't so because many of the jobs that we are trying to do are information worker intensive, and believe me, there are a lot of kids in a lot of different parts of the world who are working very, very hard to compete and have it. So, you know, we as a country, we as a society need to make sure, how do we get ahead, how do we train really in very powerful ways. And that is huge economic pressure on each and every country to say, how do we change and enhance our education system to meet the driving needs that are there. The fourth, you know, factor, of course, is in terms of the economic pressures. And in today's environment, those are not becoming easier, whether we look at it for students or we look at it for institutions or for governments, you know, across all of them. So I have a few data points. You know, just the tuition has actually been rising higher than housing prices and everything else. So, you know, the bottom dark blue curve is around housing prices. In pre-bubble, you know, people just made the assumption that, hey, if I bought a house at whatever price, you know, I expected it to go up, so it's a good investment. I think students are probably facing a similar dilemma as the cost of education keeps going up, to say, you know, hey, I have to pay a lot of money for a college education. I know it will pay off at a later point in time. I can pay off the loans, but I think it is getting harder. So cost is certainly a big imperative, and this is coupled with the fact that, especially in the United States, the amount of money that the states are putting in is going rapidly down. In the state of Washington, where I am, the budgets in the last 5 years, what state provides, have gone down 20%. And that is, of course, affecting the students and how the tuitions are reflected for what the, you know, students need to pay. And so, you know, the economics are pretty hard and are saying, you know, how can we leverage technology? A lot of other domains where technology has led transformation seems it's bypassed education. And I think it's good, exciting times where we're going to see some of the changes. There's also, I think, issues in terms of what are we teaching? You know, are we preparing the students for the right skill sets? to get the jobs because most people are looking. So firstly, globally it's being acknowledged that, this is not working too well. Both, the world is changing, and so you need to do, I trained for a world that doesn't exist. Or, when you start seeing the chronic mismatch between skills and the work environments that are there. So it's not that you're training once. This is a lifelong thing where you have to continuously train all of the time. It's also in just much more, so these are a few slides I'm using, courtesy McKinsey. McKinsey in September 2012, did a fairly broad evaluation asking what the institutions think, what the employers think, and what the students themselves think. And there is a big mismatch. So the universities are, 72% are saying, we think, we are training pretty well for the work environment. The employers say 45%, much smaller number you're doing. And the students' confidence that I'm getting trained is even lower that is there. I'll show you, some statistics for India later on in the talk where in some way the industry, the IT industry has given up on the institutions, colleges, training them well. They take everyone, they pick the brightest, and then they say, come, we'll give you, train you for 6 months, 9 months on our own coin, and, then you'll go and work for us. That's there. And these are pretty deep issues, and, again, to give you a little bit of a global perspective here. So, here you'll see some of the countries, there are a lot of factors, could not afford it, had to work while studying, not interested in higher education. And this is providing you a little bit of global perspective where in countries like the U.S., et cetera, we see a little bit, the cost is too much, I got to work, the two are related to each other, but I'd like to get a higher education. While in other countries, Turkey, India, we're saying a couple of things. Not only the cost is high, I don't believe it's going to provide a lot of value that is associated. And in countries like UK and Saudi Arabia, again, cost is high, but I'm not interested. Many people are losing interest. So we need to really think globally around what is happening, what are some of the factors, and what we do, and how can technology really provide actually leverage across these concerns that we're seeing. And finally, in this section, it's not just the traditional knowledge skills that I need. There are a lot of 21st century skills that are becoming fundamentally important in the workplace to succeed, and how do we go and do that? Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, we are working with the OECD organization to say, how can we kind of really articulate what are the needs and the skills that are needed, how might we test for them? And if you do a combination of those things, if you say what you measure, you drive outcomes towards that, hope is that this can lead to the proper, training of the skills. Now, that's a lot of, I've been talking about some of the problematic sides of things. I think there's good stuff happening too and insights that we're getting that can say, how we can get better. So one is, actually there's a lot of history data, but because of, just momentum past, we haven't done anything about. And that is, lectures are a terrible format to teach. Okay, the traditional lecture model is a broken model in terms of learning. So, this work, Carl Wieman at the bottom, he's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and he's been very concerned about science education. And the data that you see there is not from, random schools. These might be Harvard, Princeton's, Colorado Boulder. So, good schools. And if you say, when students learn, in these courses, they learn less than 30% of the new concepts that you're trying to teach that they didn't already know in a traditional lecture model. And these could be engaging, wonderful lectures, but students are not learning. If you transform with even some relatively simple kinds of technology in the classroom, and these are things from clickers, a lot of questions that you have, small group engagement within the classroom. When you do those things, you can change those to 50 to 80% learning outcomes in terms of new things. And these results hold even when you're teaching very large classes. So suddenly your 300 person introductory course can be a much better learning outcome-based course that you can do. So you got to think about technology in many, many different dimensions. Of course, we're also seeing a big transformation from the traditional model. And, this is getting quite a lot. I mean, certainly devices and one-to-one, especially in K-12, is becoming college students always kind of had devices. But though it's never in higher ed used in any consistent way, you would say how you do it. But, going to this concept of both personalized learning and mastery learning, that you learn one thing before you move on, to the next. That, it's not you tell everybody, 2 days for the bicycle and then 2 days for the unicycle. You say, master the bicycle first before you move on to the unicycle, makes a huge difference. How do you go to flipped classrooms, again, is becoming, and part of the way the MOOCs are being used is also in terms of flipped classrooms rather than just saying, there's somebody, globally recognized that who's just, teaching you. How do we get to more interactive courseware? How do we get to assessment schemes where you're not just getting your weekly homework, that gets graded 2 weeks later and comes back to you? How are you getting immediate feedback? We know fundamentally that immediate feedback, makes a difference. So there are many interesting, insights that are coming that technology suddenly, allows us to support. And certainly, the IT innovations and, that revolution is significantly, again, enabling things, from cloud and analytics so that every CIO doesn't have to implement these things locally themselves. They can be much more easily available. And I have one slide just on, if you look at a lot of talk about online education and MOOCs and everything else that's going on, people might say, oh, it allows me to do anywhere, anytime learning. It allows me to rewind. It allows me to do a lot of things. I think one of the beauties of, or one of the killer things that you finally get with digital, where people are doing stuff on devices, taking things, is you start getting data. Data starts driving feedback loops. Are you learning? What causes learning? What causes people to drop out? What mechanism works? What doesn't? And whether it's at the student level, whether it's at the individual teacher and course level, or whether it is on the large science basis itself. Just from the first MOOC course, on edX, they generated 230 million interactions. It's never been done before. You've never had that kind of data. I have an interesting thing at the bottom, as an analogy. So, human sexual behavior preferences, it's been a topic for a long time, but people never understood. And if I was to ask a question to somebody, people lied in the sense, nobody wants to disclose that side of the personal. Last time I was at the Harvard Business School bookstore, picked up this book, which is called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. Suddenly there is a lot of science happening because you can observe people's behavior on the internet. Suddenly there is a lot of real data that is there that can help us understand an aspect of human behavior. Suddenly what is happening in the education world as we go digital is we'll suddenly have the data that will allow us to learn truly what people do and what happens. So in terms of the opportunity, that these multiple factors coming together is that I think we can work towards quality education for everyone, everywhere, affordably, and that is really, really important. And as Thomas Friedman said, big breakthroughs happen when what is suddenly possible meets what is desperately needed. I think education is the fundamental, it is the foundation for the society, for us to all, for our kids in the U.S. to learn, live well even, in other parts of the world, kids need to be educated, they need to feel opportunity, and that is necessary, you know, and I think suddenly we have many things that are happening that make it possible. So let me talk a little bit about, you know, the transformations that are underway, and I'll talk, you know, pretty briefly about them and focus quite a bit on the MOOCs. Firstly, when I look at, you know, the role technology can play, there are many different aspects to it. You know, it is one around enabling new pedagogies, and these can be domain-specific things, you know, how to do peer-to-peer grading in the best possible way, or how do you build deep models of, you know, student learning and how they learn basic algebra or math or something like that, and Carnegie Learning, and you know, a lot of people have gone and done that. You know, so it's somewhat specialized stuff, which is really, really important for things to happen. The second is, you know, how do we, I think there's a whole industry around how do we create interesting materials and the tools and the technologies and the delivery that correspond to that. And the third is around, you know, what I would call more the infrastructure in some sense, you know, and foundations. And these vary from all of the work that you do around basic information worker things that I would say, you know, from how you author, read, note take, collaborate, you know, in classroom interactions, to core student management, and all of them are important. Okay, I think some of the newer stuff is happening in this dimension that we're changing, but all of these elements are fundamental and complementary, so I just wanted to say, you know, there's a holistic view to the whole thing, and yesterday we were really, you know, happy to talk about what we call the student advantage there for students, at least all of the office and the, you know, the assets are now free for the student side. You know, that we are really doing. I want to shift a little bit to MOOCs because there is quite a lot of talk about MOOCs. You know, most of the companies, Coursera, edX, Udacity, the founders are actually colleagues, friends of mine, and I've engaged quite a bit with them. And suddenly, you know, it's very exciting, and the rate of adoption and the rate of change, and when I talk to my old faculty colleagues and across universities, they're really excited because the amount of discussion that's happening in the academia around education, what is learning about, what causes learning, it's more than it has ever been before. Okay, so that amount of discussion that is happening is just, you know, fantastic, and we're seeing rapid movement in terms of, you know, a lot of courses are available. You know, one of three students in America is taking at least one online course. The number of students who are doing, interacting with it is going. So, you know, it's a movement that is taking place. It's on top of mind. And that's always goodness. I mean, as I'll say, I think we still have a long way to go. But it's a great start for the iterative process. It's also becoming, you know, it's really important in the consumer's mind whether it is becoming more acceptable or not. And we see positive movement in that too, where, you know, 77% of the academic leaders are saying, you know, it can be similar or even in some cases better than the traditional model. Certainly at Stanford, we had several cases of actually very remote thing where people studied in small groups, and they did much better than people who were in the classroom. So we have some very old data too, where the actual results, you know, were much better. In general, my view of technology and adoption is it happens, and this is almost for any technology, and this is regardless in three phases. The phase one is we just take digital versions of the old analog processes. So, you know, I might look at MIT OpenCourseWare, you know, as that phase where we took the lectures, recorded them, took whatever the homeworks were, posted them, and we say, you know, here they're in a digital form, go and consume them. So that'll be, you know, what I would call phase one in some sense. The phase two is where you still take that same thing, but you say, you know, now you're digital, I can do some more things. I can start inserting quizzes, you know, at short intervals. I can add some discussion boards. So I would say, you know, where MOOCs today are really is in phase two. Nothing has fundamentally changed. A lot of the university vertically integrated structures, how we teach, you know, that things are still 10 or 14 week long. A lot of the old things still remain. And I think it takes a little bit of time, and we'll get there, is where you fundamentally rethink, okay, in terms of how education, you know, how learning, what are the things students want to learn, need to happen. And certainly in the K-12, you can look a little bit of what Khan Academy and Sal Khan are trying to do with very short things, competency-based, coaches that can assist as much more transformative things to the model. And we're going to see, you know, how can we go towards that. And the MOOC report card itself is, you know, reasonable. You know, this was a Wall Street Journal report from just a few days ago, you know, 8th of October. You know, we find that most of these students taking it are actually already who have a degree and graduation, that people are signing off because, you know, they're too busy to finish. The one I liked was one, I forgot that I was in the course. You know, and of course, if it's free, you know, so I don't think we are worrying too much about how many dropouts. You know, the wonderful thing is that there are so many people completing the course. Like, you know, 155K signed up for the 6.002 course, but 7,100 completed. That's a hell of a lot of people, you know, who are learning a lot and completing, and you've got to look at the positive side rather than the negative side. You know, when Udacity was working with San Jose State, and, you know, the first results of pass rates were bad because, you know, but these were students who were already failing and not a regular pool. As you start looking at some of the recent results, you know, the MOOC results with some of the faculty and tutors' assistants, they're looking pretty good in terms of, you know, pass rates that you're seeing with these students. And we are, again, getting lots of data, you know, where people are saying, hey, I want to watch only small things, not a lot of, you know, big long thing. So even if you post long videos, the amount of time that people actually spend watching is pretty little. So again, you know, wonderful things are happening in terms of as we're getting data. I briefly wanted to take you to, you know, offer you a little bit of Microsoft perspective in this, in a few slides. So the industry itself, it's not just universities who are doing this, the industry itself, and we are just an example, I'm sure the other people are doing similar things too, are trying to see as you train people on the industry and the skills that are needed to get you jobs are, you know, learning and using these techniques. And we have really three things that we're doing, two in a commercial sense, the other in a research sense, something we call the Microsoft Virtual Academy, you know, which is an open way to go and learn things about HTML5, XAML, Windows, virtualization, all kinds of things. And, you know, this is as large as some of the other MOOCs that you see with over 1.25 million learners, hundreds of courses on topics that will give people jobs. Again, when I think about these new things, we shouldn't think of it narrowly in terms of, you know, just subjects we traditionally teach in universities. The amount of learning that needs to happen is much, much larger. You know, in fact, in 2008, I had written a, you know, white paper for the Prime Minister of India, you know, where his question was really around, there are 500 million people we need to train in India, you know, out of the 1.2 billion. How are we going to train? The scale at which things need to be done and trained is just enormous, and how we think about it is really, you know, IT Academy is a similar thing where we've taken a lot of courses around technology and other things, and this is a program for schools where whole schools or in some cases states or countries, you know, the whole of Netherlands is signed up so that in their school, in their schools, all of these things, you know, courses are available and people can go and take. I want to move quickly to something, you know, this is a research experiment we did, and again, to provide you a global perspective rather than just the U.S. perspective on thing, where our India team said, you know, how do we contextualize MOOCs in the context of India? And they came up with an experiment that you know, they called Massively Empowered Classrooms. Just in terms of scale, a little bit of a sense, and they're focusing on engineering, you know, schools, there are 4 million students, you know, who are enrolled in engineering. okay? And that's around at least 10x the number of students enrolled in the United States. And I would say, you know, while the students are 10x larger, qualified faculty is 10x lower. So the gap is really, you know, 1:100 in some sense that we are trying to deal with. You know, we have these colleges, they're 80 students per faculty member, and I would say 90% of these faculty are absolutely not trained to, you know, teach these students in what needs to be learned. So the question is, you know, how do you go and handle these things? And the traditional MOOCs are not being received for a variety of reasons, from, you know, content, incentives, awareness. Basically, the MOOCs that we are doing in the West affect around 0.1% of the student population, and these are the students and population who is already self-motivated, who is already eager, prepared to go and take these courses. So from a societal perspective, MOOCs are not affecting large number of people we really need to go and address. You know, because any societal thing, you can't say I cover just, you know, a very small top fraction. You have to say, how do you address the broad set of people that you need to trace? And we simply are. You know, the students aren't interested, the faculty aren't interested. You know, it's just a big problem that is there. So the take they did on this was, so instead of thinking of a MOOC as a self-contained thing where people are going to take, you know, they looked at it really as a 21st century textbook in some sense that was to assist the local faculty in trying to teach. You know, the curriculum is pushed out. You know, people can further enhance the curriculum. It is not a fixed, you know, it's given. So you say, how do you add a bunch of local stuff? The analytics is for their specific college or class is available to those teachers that is there. And of course, we had to address a lot of offline issues too, because even though every college claims they have, you know, enough bandwidth, the reality was that it just didn't work. So, you know, as you design the systems, you got to think about it very differently. So I said, so, you know, bandwidth is a huge issue. We got to deal with it. Quality of content is not sufficient, so you just say, I take the famous professor and I put the course out, doesn't make a difference. You know, they study for their exams, their syllabus, their level of level at which they can understand might be different. It needs to be done very differently, and a lot of the social and competitive aspects are really important. And also the belief that unless the local faculty are engaged and interested, change is not going to happen. Okay, so you can't say, you know, the local faculty is ignoring, people are just going to learn, students are going to learn, because again, this goes back to 0.1% of the students do self-engage, but a lot of the rest of them don't. So how you drive that engagement and that motivation is, you know, significantly important. And then plagiarism was a big issue. So, you know, in the MOOC style of thing where they put a quiz, they put a very hard question. And the online version, you know, almost every kid, you know, student got it right. They put the same variant of that question in a proctored environment. 3% of the people got it. Okay. So how do we think through all of these details and make them work out really right as we think about a global scale in which these things are happening, you know, becomes hard, you know, so change is hard. Many, many stakeholders are there. We need to bring them along as we think about the revolution that is taking place. And that's why I said, you know, we are in the beginning stages of the journey. It's a very exciting journey that we need to take as we go on. So the last, you know, two, three just slides and as we think about it. So let me talk a little bit to the future. So the first is, you know, as I've been saying a little bit, many questions remain as we go on this journey. To me, you know, how do you motivate local faculty, I don't think that is going away, you know, both from a political perspective, where you suddenly can't fire all the teachers and faculty in places, to how do we motivate students that are not self-driven. And even in the U.S., you know, things like long-term costs and operations of MOOCs. So, you know, the professor is often, you know, I as a Stanford can say, you know, very happy first time the experiment is run, but on an ongoing basis, I don't want to spend TAs or my own cycles continuously trying to revise, you know, especially at the top universities. You know, you're focused on research, get things forward, and so how are the monetary models going to work? And that's why, you know, in the relationship between Georgia Tech and Udacity, you know, Udacity is putting in essentially TAs and paid for, and there's charges associated with it, so that on an ongoing basis, you know, students are really taking care of what you do. I think there is also this issue of, you know, modularity of content and courses, where they are today still packaged in pretty large chunks, and there is very difficulty in terms of bringing them together. So if you look at a textbook and how a professor, you know, a faculty member teaches, they pick portions of the thing that they decide to teach, they bring in some outside materials, they add some of their own material to construct something, you know, that they're going to do. And today's systems electronically just don't make it very easy to go and do that. It's much more, you know, Khan Academy and other people that are doing. And you also want the thing that, you know, where the credentials are separated from, you know, people delivering those from the authors of, either the authors of the course or the platform developers of the course. So, you know, neither the faculty member. Again, I think it will be, you know, closer to a model of a book in some sense, or what, you know, somebody's called a packaged online course thing that will be there. And I think this importance is also there because what the local person does is also contextualize to their students, to the local context, you know, that is there, and personalize that keeps them engaged. That will be really important. So last slide in terms of, you know, what are some of the things I personally think are important, and I'm, you know, kind of deeply thinking about what needs to be done. I mean, of course, this list is very, very large. I mean, so it's not a comprehensive list, just, you know, things that are top of mind for me and for us as we are thinking about where we are headed. One is, I do believe we need to think about how are we empowering local faculty around, whether it's K through 12 and what we're doing with teachers, or in terms of the faculty that we have at the institutions, because they bring a lot of insight and context about their students. It's not that the material or the MOOC that is produced by somebody in an ivory tower is not useful, but it is much more about they want to leverage pieces of that and incorporate it rather than just totally isolated, because totally isolated, it'll cover the top 1% of the world, but the 99% need to be addressed in a different way. The second, you know, aspect to me is around much more modular content with clear rights. So the modular content part is, if you look at Khan Academy, if you look at, you know, how do you make it much more around much smaller learning packages or concepts that are there that can then be pieced together by the local faculty to personalize, to contextualize to who their audiences are, and also for people who are lifelong learning in the, you know, in the industry. It's a little bit like Wikipedia. You know, Wikipedia is not books that you do. You know, it's so useful. It's article at a time. You can go and look at something that is useful and change it. And if you do it modular, the rights part of it here has to do with, if people are combining things together, then you have to have clarity of what can I do with it, you know, in terms of copyright, in terms of media rights. So I think we got very confused In the other part of the publishing world, and what I could use, and the rights were in many cases not clear, but I think having clear rights associated with the modular content is really important as we think about it. The third element to me is around really, you know, powerful yet simple authoring and composition tools for mashups. So if I have this modular content, you know, how can I, again, let me take a more K through 12 analogy, you know, can I piece together the interactive exercises and con videos, you know, sell con videos and my own video and something from YouTube into a lesson that I say, go and watch it at home. I get all of the analytics, you know, and do it. It's almost, you know, another analogy would be if most of the people who build PowerPoint decks don't start from scratch. You know, you assemble from many things, your own past content, you know, your new content, some colleague of yours did things. How can you assemble things and use them because you're trying to contextualize it to a given audience? So if I look at the deck I'm using here, you know, it's not that I started on everything from scratch. I pulled from different people, but I said, you know, this is my target audience. What do I want to say to this audience? And that contextualization, you know, for creating mashups, I believe, is really important. Once you start doing this, you know, what becomes important is that if I am the teacher, I want to get the analytics. You know, so today the world is, if I'm, let's say I'm in the apps world, you know, I'm using an app to teach some math concepts, you know, another app to, you know, within the same thing to teach algebra, another. And all these app people, it's very nice, they're delivered as services in some sense, but the analytics goes to that app provider. So I, as a teacher, you know, I have to go to different people's view of the analytics, look at 10 different things. I have no idea, you know, how much time they spent on the whole thing. So either I'm constrained to a very single environment, or if I'm creating a mashup, I am not getting the data. I think the students and the faculty should be getting the data in an integrated way, regardless of the kind of mashup that I'm creating. And I think this is possible, okay, to do in terms of the interoperability, in terms of LTI, in terms of, you know, how richer data than LTI does we get together. The last two are, you know, somewhat general, so I think it is really, collaboration is really important and social. So just one example I would give here is, although, you know, you have these MOOCs, which anybody can go and watch, we don't have to watch a lesson by myself sitting in my living room or wherever else in my dorm room. You know, even though we are in different places, can I and three of my three other friends watch the lesson together? Okay, and as I pause somewhere, you know, pauses for everybody, and we are in a Skype session, we are discussing. You know, as I hit a question, all of us hit a question in parallel, and we can chat about it. Stanford played with a, you know, similar model in a very analog VHS tapes world in the late 70s called tutored video instruction. And this was the thing where I was saying people learned better than people in the Stanford classrooms. Okay, so there's just a lot of things that we can do in this space. And I think if we combine all of these elements with the data and the analytics and the learning insights that we get, I think we can realize the vision of both personalized learning for the students, and we need to think, of course, hard also about credentials that are meaningful and that lead to employment, you know, that lead to advancement in careers for our students, and we need to think about in those terms. So, thank you very much. I hope some of this was relevant insights to you, and I am happy to take a few questions. So anything from remote or local?
You touched on this very briefly at the end, but would you say a little bit more about verifying the credentialing or verifying the actual student work done by the student and learning done by the student. As we get into remote and shared activities, how do we in fact assess the student learning?
So there's work that is happening on the technological angle, and then, you know, we need to do some work at the system. So on the technological element, what people are doing is, you know, if you're typing an answer, I can actually analyze your keystrokes. You have a certain typing pattern. And if it is different, I can know it's different from, you know, you got to have webcams that are continuously there and, you know, that they're checking often enough. So there's a lot of fingerprinting and other kinds of stuff that you can do that can help. But, you know, all of these things at some level are spoofable. But we need to, you know, think about those. And the other thing that's happening is in terms of more proctored and locations. And if you're going more to a world of flipped classrooms, et cetera, they're physical places too, and they're real people, you know, who are engaged in monitoring, you know, whether you're learning or not. Because again, as I said, you know, so if I look at the 4 million students in India, there are actually physical people who are monitoring. you know, I mean, it's not even corresponding to the students. They're not people who can monitor things. Our problem is we don't have schemes on how to tell them how to learn. These teachers are not qualified for learning, but they're at least qualified for proctoring.
Yeah, I think the irony here is that the closer we get to a more traditional model of proctoring to ensure that it's actually the student who's doing the work and it's the learning that's being assessed, the further we get away from some of the creative delivery aspects that you have suggested.
Yeah, there is a balance and a challenge, and that is there. Anybody else? Somebody, well, thank you very much. Wonderful to have you here this afternoon.